Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome back to a new edition of the Just the Freedom Show. I am your darling and dashing host, Push Nevada. I have a very interesting guest on the show tonight, Reggie Bullock. He's a public speaker, a role model, filmmaker, and he's from the Bronx. And he is here to discuss his new film, War for Our Soul. Mr. Bullock, are you there?
Rosetta Lucas Quisenberry.
I'm sorry?
Hello, this is Rosetta Lucas Quiz.
Rosetta? Hello? Reggie Bullock, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Give us a brief bio of yourself, and then let's get into the film. I want to talk about the film. I got some questions.
Brief bio, former educator for about 17 years, decided to get into filmmaking about 10 years ago, but actually I was indirectly involved in it. Being a history teacher, what I would do with a lot of the students that I work with is I would try to make historical films relevant to them. So I would take the most interesting clips of, let's say, a show like The Eyes on the Prize. I would take those film clips and then add some of the most updated, relevant music to those kids so it would get their interest, and then shorten and condense these films that were sometimes an hour or 2 or 3 hours long, condense it into 15 minutes because I knew their attention spans were very, very short. By doing this, I would always have another teacher that would come in and sit there and watch this and say, where did you get this from? And it was just something I wouldn't say by accident, it was by design, but something I had created as a hobby on the side, and then after a while, I started getting better and better at this to the point where some people from the outside said you should really go into the film industry, and I did it about 10 years ago, and that's what got me into the whole interest of making historical short films so that it would keep the interest of our kids because their average attention span is no more than 10 minutes long anyway. So it would give the teacher, the pastor, the youth counselor, or whoever was in that classroom environment with the kid, it would give them approximately 45 minutes to discuss this 15-minute short film.
Okay. I know that Michael Beasden has definitely endorsed the film, and that's a pretty big thing. He's encouraged people to go and see it. He calls it a must-see film. How are people receiving it
Well, the film's been out. I put it on the internet probably close to 2 years ago. It'll be 2 years this March. And I've received the reception for this thing has been amazing. It's something far beyond anything I could ever imagine. I cannot take the full credit for this because I really believe this was God-driven. And I say that because there's no way somebody can create a small film. And my intentions were never for this thing to go on the internet. I wanted to send this out to about 40 small black colleges, small black churches, small black youth organizations. And I never expected anything other than one teacher or one counselor to get their hands on this, show it to kids, give them a sense of the things of the blood that many people had shed to put them in the positions they're in today, and just potentially change one kid's life. That was my intention. I never, never in my wildest of dreams expected 10 million people to see this thing, Michael Baisden. And just the other day, there was a newspaper article done on one of the top internet online magazines in London, England, that did a full front-page story about this film. So once again, I believe it's all God. I can't take the credit for it because if I was that talented, boy, I'd be a billionaire right now. But it's just one of those things where it went viral. For some reason, it is touching the hearts of many people. And for the most part, it's very, very rare that I'll get any type of criticism. And the only type of criticism that I've received so far is, how come you left this out or how come you didn't put this or that in? And usually I respond by saying it's only a 10, 15-minute film, so you're not going to get every problem or every solution in 15 minutes.
I understand it's a matter of time and space. I want to say for the record that Rosetta Quisenberry is on the line, and she's going to join us in the last 10 minutes of the show, and we may take some callers. The lines are lighting up. But I want you, just for the those that don't know about the film, just tell us a little bit about what the film is about.
Well, before I tell you what the film is about, I could do me just back up for 1 second and tell you the inspiration behind the film. The night of the election, I'm watching the first man of color in the White House, and when I see this, I moved to the point where I called my mother and her two sisters, because all of these women are three African-American women born during the 30s. So they had seen the struggles of Jim Crow in North Carolina, and I wanted to get their perspective of being in their mid-70s and upper 70s of what this was like. And each one said it was from God, but my Aunt Teen, who is the intellectual of the three, she was the one that said that this is an amazing moment, this is all from God, if only young African-American kids could appreciate what is taking place right now, if they only could remember all of the struggles that just took place over the last 40, 50 years, then they would realize how special this was. And so at that moment when I got off the phone, I decided to try to put all of the struggles through pictures and through music into a 10-minute, 15-minute film that would hopefully reach one kid that's sitting there, their borderline student, maybe D's and C minuses, and maybe they would see some of the struggles and it would inspire them to say, okay, it's a new day. Maybe I can flip this. Maybe I can change these things. And with that being said, then the film is more or less a complete composite from slavery. And our history starts long before slavery. That was one of the complaints. Why did we start with slavery? And I know that our history started long before slavery. But to show them the recent struggles that we've gone through, that's what really the entire film is about. And can we change this? Can we change the drug dealing, the shooting, the amount of people in prison, the teen pregnancy, the AIDS amongst African-American women? Can we change this? And it leaves, the film tries to leave a little hope at the end that we have the possibility of change because we've overcome some tremendous odds before and we can do it again.
Okay, so what are some of the things going on in the film? What kind of image or music are you using to convey that message?
Some of the images, once again, I showed a lot of clips of some lynchings. This has been one of the struggles to get it into certain schools because a lot of people are very uncomfortable with showing our history, and it's interesting that if you show the history of the Holocaust or of Japanese Americans thrown in camps, during World War II, it seems to be okay, but when it comes to showing our histories, particularly the visual pictures, because we have a lot of history of we have a lot of visual pictures of African Americans being lynched in front of courthouses. So I took pictures like that, some of the most raw pictures, to try to not make kids angry, but show them that these were the people that died. These were your ancestors that died, so that you would have the opportunity to be able to go to a library or go to a something simplistic as a water fountain or do whatever you want. You would have that option to do that. Some of the other images are images of things that are going on today. I show a lot of young kids running up to a car trying to sell drugs to somebody else to hammer home the point that that we can change some of these conditions that are going on today. But one of the things I would point out that I want a lot of people to know is that some people look at the film as this is strictly targeting young people. Well, it is. It's targeting the young people that I worked with, and I work with a lot of at-risk youth, but it's not targeting the entire African-American youthful population. And the reason why I say that, there are thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of black kids that are doing extremely well in black colleges and in some predominantly white colleges. They're doing extremely well all across the country, and those kids deserve credit also. But this film was designed for that at-risk kid. It wasn't designed for every single person.
You said, and I quote, "The devil could not succeed in the urban world without his recruits from the miseducated and misguided segments of the black race," end quote. That's a pretty loaded statement. So the devil's recruits are only miseducated, misguided folk from black urban communities?
No, I don't know where you got that quote from. I didn't say that direct quote. But I will say this, that one of the things that I've noticed is that without a lack of education, a lack of education, we are going to struggle. And this is something that, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, if an African-American man or woman had a degree, that was considered honorable. Now, within certain pockets of the United States, if you have a degree, people will tease you. People will call you a nerd. People will say you're blending into a white world, and you're not. You're just trying to educate yourself. So, you know, that's what I would say as far as education. If we don't have, if we don't value our education, we can continue to get lost. But I will say this: I did one radio interview. It had to be 5 months ago, and one older gentleman said this so eloquently. He said, "Mr. Bullock, I appreciate the fact you're trying to get our youth to become educated, but you know there are a lot of educated people on Wall Street. There are a lot of educated people that do secret deals behind at boardrooms that can hurt people not only within this country but around the world. So if we don't, it's one thing to have education, but you better have some spirituality behind that education, because if you don't, you can become an educated crook." And he was so right in that. So that's one of the things I would say. You know, we want to value our kids. We want to impress on our kids that education is important, but that education is meaningless if you're going to take it and use it to do things that are going to hurt our economy, our system of living, and the world.
I guess perhaps this matter speaks to the issue of perhaps some would suggest the lack of black leadership, whereas the Du Bois' talented 10th. What's going on now and how we are handling our own community, our own selves, particularly in light of Martin Luther King's birthday and his memory and his legacy, and listening to you talk about the problems of today, it sounds kind of bleak, like we haven't come very far.
Well, in certain senses, we have come far. In certain respects, we haven't. I will say this. I have gone through, I mean, I thought I was the most educated. I thought I was a person that knew everything that you could ever know. And touring the country over the last year and a half about this film, I mean, I'm just learning things, particularly from older people, that is blowing me away. And one of the things that addresses what you just said is how far we've come, whether it's bleak or not, is the simple fact that I talked to Dick Gregory's, the former comedian and activist Dick Gregory's press secretary. And one of the things she impressed upon me, and this woman is in her 70s, and I said to her, as I go out speaking to people, particularly African-Americans, during my tour, what would you recommend me saying? And she said, you know what, I wouldn't even talk to the youth. I wouldn't even talk to the kids in college. You know who you need to talk to? You need to talk to the ones, the talented tenth. You need to talk to the ones that are doing well and have their degrees and have their doctorates, and you need to ask them, how come we can never get on the same page? If we go into the room and the issue is saving children's lives and changing the educational system for our kids, we'll all sit there, we'll debate, we'll come up with all of these great ideas, the think tanks and all of this other stuff, but when it comes to leaving that room, we all want to know who is going to get the credit for this idea. She said our egos are the most destructive thing to African-American leadership. She said this is why we have so many different groups, and they're all trying to do the same thing, but at the end of the day, they end up butting heads because our egos get in the way. So that's something that I look upon, and I say to myself, you know, Reggie, it's very hypocritical for you to point to our youth and say you need to pull up your pants, you need to do this, you need to do that, when our leaders, they may have their pants pulled up, but what's not pulled up is their ideology. They're not together on the same page for the same thing when it comes to leaving that room. Every group wants the credit. They want to get the credit for whatever they're trying to create. And that to me, is a huge, huge problem that we face.
Well, I think one of the issues, and I think this was pointed out on the State of the Black Union, that show that Kevin Smiley does, and one of the panelists asked, she was talking about the inefficacy of historically black colleges and universities, and she asked Cornel West and Michael Dyson, who I would consider part of that whole talented tenth reality, why they were not teaching at HBCUs. And they kind of brushed it off as Cornel West said, well, it's a matter of one's calling. And Michael Dyson said that it was a matter of money, not being paid enough money. So what do you think about that? Does a black educated have a responsibility towards HBCUs or to support a black education? Or should they be allowed to go and work wherever they want?
I'm on both sides of the fence. Part of me feels that they should be able to go wherever they want, but then there's another part of me that way down inside my gut that says, and being a former athlete, you know, I saw what happened to the black college. Black colleges, as far as sports, used to be the most dominant thing you could ever find.
Hold on. What do you mean they used to be the most dominant thing? In what regard?
In what regards, we were number one in basketball, football. In order for professional sports to survive, they had to come to our campuses, to HBCU campuses, in order to recruit. And now these universities, they're falling apart. They have no money because now all of our athletes, all of our top athletes are going to predominantly white universities, and they're giving them millions and millions and billions of TV revenue are going to some of the top universities, and meanwhile, some of these black universities are struggling to stay open. And so when I think about an educator and an athlete, it's almost the same thing to me because I'm like, some of our most talented are off in other places because they do need the money to survive. But at the same time, I think this is where if we had that unity and we stayed at one university, I mean, our universities would be so rich and powerful and strong. And these would be universities that, believe it or not, I think over the course of time, I think you'd have white Europeans from all over the world trying to attend our universities because they would see the value of learning. And also for just the pure entertainment aspect, they would say the best are performing at these places. So we don't have that anymore, and it's sad because, like I said, a lot of these universities, I remember there was a time when the Morgan State and Grambling thing, that was the biggest thing going. Grambling University had every pro. Now Grambling University is lucky to have a football stadium that can survive from year to year, and it's sad, and it shouldn't be like that.
Well, you're talking about sports, though, and I think the panelists on that State of the Black Union address show said that one of the reasons why the HBCUs are failing is because black alumni, for instance, don't give back. So what does that mean? I mean, is it a matter of sports that should be thought of when you think about struggling HBCUs? Or is it a matter of quality education? Because that's another side of that reality, too. HBCUs and what they were originally designed to do. And some people would say they weren't really designed to educate of black people. I understand the whole sports thing, but I think that perhaps one of the major problems is the quality of education at those particular schools. And there's the economic factor. Perhaps black educators don't want to return to those schools because they can't make money. They can't. I mean, I can understand why Cornell West wouldn't want to go to Clark Atlanta and teach.
Right. Well, the only reason I bring up sports is sports, as far as the way our institutions work around the country, show me a powerful sports program at a predominantly white university, and I will show you buildings that are being built. Okay? You show me a powerful sports program around the country, and I will show you dormitories that are being built. So, sports,
yeah,
believe it or not, that wasn't a major
projection
from the beginning.
Are you suggesting that HBCUs are competing technologically or building libraries, et cetera, are competing with northern universities?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Are you saying that HBCUs are effectively competing with northern universities, whereas you do have those, and sports money is important to a university, of course it is, but they perhaps take that money and they, of course, reinvest it back into the school. They build better libraries, better facilities, technology, et cetera. So are you saying that HBCUs are competing with northern universities, with the big sports programs, et cetera?
No. I'm not saying they're competing with it as far as sports, but what I am saying is that this is just one element. I'm just talking about sports as one element. There's so many elements as to why these universities are falling apart. But one of the things I know, one of the reasons why I told my daughter to attend University of Connecticut was simply the fact that once their sports program for the men and women started becoming huge, once Georgetown started becoming huge, Georgetown was a very prominent institution before they had the sports program, but once sports programs today, it's a billion-dollar industry, they are leading universities to build, to hire different teachers to come in. And so I'm not saying sports is the end-all, be-all to save a university, particularly a HBC university, because long ago when these universities first started, they didn't have billion-dollar sports industries to begin with. I'm just talking about sports in general as far as the type of money that comes in. It's sad that we don't have that billion-dollar, where they pay these for CBS and NBC when they have the NCAA tournament on. That is huge money, not just going to the sports program, but it goes to buildings and facilities all around the campus, which makes the campus stronger, which makes people want to go to that school. And once they go to that school, now it becomes a highly competitive school. It becomes a hard school for people to get into. And then so the standard and the ranking goes up each year. But once again, please don't confuse me. I'm not saying that sports is the end-all, be-all to resurrecting our institutions. We do have to give back. We do have to give back. We do. Our alumni do have to support these universities completely, completely have to do this. I don't know what our reason for doing this is. I think part of it is we think that by investing in other communities or investing in other products, we think that we have the real thing when I don't think we have the belief that our own thing is the real thing, that we are just as smart and as intelligent as anyone else in the world. And I still look at Morehouse and Spelman as two. Spelman at 1 year, this had to be at least 7 years ago, they made the list as one of the top 13 institutions, black and white, in the whole country. And they don't have a strong sports program. So, I mean, sports is not the end-all, be-all. But that is one aspect of money making revenue that I look at, and I literally say, wow, a lot of these major institutions are feeding off of our athletes to build their institution,
sure,
to bring in the best.
Sure. Mr. Bullock, you are a man of faith. What role do you think the church would play in the scheme of this?
Ooh, now you're gonna get me in trouble, Brother Jeremy. You about to get me in trouble here. The church, there's so many aspects we can play in this. I think we had a strong foothold in the 60s of doing the right thing. What I'm seeing now is the church, we're at a divided state as far as black America when the church is concerned. A lot of churches are into making money now. One of the big gospels now is health and wealth. If we can tell people that they're going to get healthy and wealthy, the bigger our church is, the more you believe, the more money you're going to get. And so that's a big, that was something that, if you're old enough, Reverend Ike was somebody that people laughed at in the 60s. in the early 50s for doing this. They couldn't believe, wow, how can this man roll around with 2-3 Rolls Royces and big diamond pinky rings and do all of this other stuff? And now that's very common. That's very common to have popular evangelist pastors rolling around like that. And we as a group of people are now starting to follow that instead of following the doctrine. And if the doctrine is truth, we should go out and help not only mankind, but particularly help within our community. And I think the church has gotten away from that. But I will say, not all churches are like this. I don't believe all churches do that. But I believe in order to survive, a lot of churches have gone that route of making money instead of looking at the big picture, reaching back and helping our youth.
Okay, yeah, that's important. An old history professor of mine told me that if you want to understand history, if you want to understand human behavior, follow the money. So I guess churches have jumped on the bandwagon. I want to get Rosetta Quisenberry on the line. Rosetta, are you there?
I'm right here listening to every word.
What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are you have deviated from the picture that I was to analyze, and I think the video was excellent.
Okay.
That's the first thing I want to say. And then you kind of deviated into the black colleges and now kind of into the black church and where are some of the problems. And one of the things that I feel very strongly is that we don't tell our youth about their history. And some of the things that this man has... Say that again. I'm losing your connection.
I don't think we're deviating. I don't think I deviated. I think it's all relevant. But what do you mean when you say we're not teaching our children our history? What do you mean?
Well, here's one of the things where he took excerpts from films, from videos. I too was a history teacher. I taught social studies here in Lexington, Kentucky, and Eyes on the Prize was one of his big videos. I used to show the entire thing of Eyes on the Prize. One of the things that he showed that was very, very prevalent where they was whipping that child's name out of him was Roots. Kunta Kinte was being beaten. What was his name? Fiddler ran in and told the man, said, y'all going to whip that child to death. And the only thing that stopped him was his own common sense and saying, making him give up his name and saying Toby. And the one thing.
Yeah, I understand that, but I'm trying to understand what you mean by we are not teaching our children our history. Do you mean we're not teaching it in school? When they're not,
we're not
available
teaching,
in
we're
books?
Not teaching. Listen. What I'm trying to say is we're not making sure that their history is taught to them. Like now we're going back. Historians are now forcing the Confederacy upon all children. Here in the state of Kentucky, they say that they got to study about the Confederacy for 5 years here in Kentucky. Back in Richmond, Virginia, I know they're studying about the Confederacy. If you don't teach them their history, somebody else is going to put their history to shame.
I understand that, and I agree with it, but I think it's important, black history is American history, and I think to understand history as a whole, American history, we do need to know about the Confederacy. I think that if you don't know the side of your opponent, you know middle of your own, and I think that the history books are out there. Everybody's writing about black history. It's a hot subject since the 70s. It's in schools, it's in colleges, and it's in high schools, and even earlier than that. So I was trying to understand. Go ahead.
Go on.
I was just trying to understand, what do you mean we're not teaching kids about their history? I think that. Don't discount the whole market-driven culture, too. I think people, young black youth today, just aren't interested in pursuing it. But I think it's there. I think it's available. It's just not about. It's not always about the schools. It's about the parents as well. There was a time when we taught our kids at home as well. So that's a very powerful statement to make, to say that we are not teaching our kids are not being taught their history. I just completely disagree. But you have a book out.
I have four books out. I don't have one book. I have four books. And I am just so very glad to meet this man. I pray that you all will get those books. And what I'm telling you is that we're not making our children look at the videos such as Eyes on the Prize, Roots, and the other videos that would make them strong in their own history. We used to teach history to our children in black churches. We have way deviated from that. You can't hardly get a program in a black church during Black History Month.
I agree, but my issue, I agree with that, but my issue is who is we? Because,
is all of us who feel our history is important. Half the time, and I want to be very honest, we deviate from our own history because we are scared or ashamed of it. We don't look at our own history because we don't want to look at it. Some of us are still wanting to get into mainstream culture so badly that we shy away from our own history. Do you hear what I'm saying?
You know what? I agree, but at some point there's a matter of, we have to look at the reason why. And I just think that this is, for a lot of people, this particular generation of black folks, they're just preoccupied with, of course, the materialism and just probably trying to move forward with the whole race thing. That is still a very painful thing in the black community. Everybody is talking about white, black, nappy head, straight hair, et cetera, et cetera. But my issue is with the accessibility of black history, and I think it's there. We are writing our own books as well, and I don't think it's just a matter of teaching black history. I think we need to know about the other side. We need to know about all of it.
I agree that we need to know about the other side, but how many of our children can honestly tell you who Emmett Lewis Till is? How many folks don't think that the civil rights movement started with Ms. Rosa Parks? What really ignited Rosa Parks was the death of Emmett Lewis Till. How many folks can tell you who Emmett Lewis Till is? How many go back and tell you about Medgar Evers?
Let's talk about your book. Let's get your book in here because we're running late on time. Tell us about your book.
Okay, there are four books there. One, A Saga of the Black Man. You look at the stereotypes of what happened to black men and the negative images that was created about the black man and then the positive images that the black man created about himself. If you look at the saga, there's part two. A Saga of the Black Man is part one. Part two is A Saga of the Black Woman. A part three is A Saga of the Black Child. And part four is A Saga of the Black Family. And they all are in separate parts. There's no book that's the same, but you've got to look at the history of what has happened to us. And
I agree.
These negative stereotypes tell so much history that we can't encompass it in this short, very, very short version of time right now. You've got to look at the pages of those books.
I agree, but again, it's still a matter of, you're saying the negative history is a matter of who's controlling it, who's writing it, and also who's perpetuating it. Tell us about a New York trip. You recently took a New York City trip of some sort.
Yes, I did. I was at BET in New York City in 2009, and they did a short. If you go to BET.com and /, and then type in Quisenberry, you can actually see the video that was done.
Thank you very much. We are completely and totally out of time. I want to thank both of you for joining us. And this was just a really good discussion. I want to invite you both back to the show But we have to go. Thank you both for joining me tonight.
Thank you,
well,
Brother Jeremy.
I thank you for having me. And if there's any way that Mr. Bullock will give me his name and numbers where I can reach him or contact him personally, I would more than appreciate it. Can you hear me?
Yes, I did. That wouldn't be a problem. If you know what, can you go to my website, warfaryoursoul.com, and just connect with me on my email, and we'll be able to exchange numbers.
Wait just one second. Mr. Bullock, please wait just one second. Let me write that down, because I want to connect
give
with you
contact.
Under every circumstance. This man deviated from your film, and there were many points. I went to the library to look your film up because I couldn't pull it up on the radio, on my computer. My computer wasn't strong enough to do that. But I guarantee you I enjoyed your video.
But thank
you
very much.
Did you hear me?
Wait just one second. He's going to give the contact information for those that are listening and want to get in touch with him about his film. So if you can give us that contact info, that would be great.
Okay, if you can go to warforyoursoul.com, and it'll have all the information on there. War, W-A-R, for, F-O-R, your, Y-O-U-R, soul, S-O-U-L.com, warforyoursoul.com. It'll have all the contact information, email addresses, all that stuff on there where you can get in contact with me.
Thank you very much. I don't think I deviated from the show. I think everything was important and relevant, but I do welcome you to come back to the show, and we can take it up from there. There's a matter of time and space here. But I want to thank you again for coming. This is the Disco Freedom Show. I'm your host, Push Nevada, signing off. Talk to you next Thursday, same place, same time. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Are you still there, Mr. Bull?
Yes, I am.
You gotta be hard, you gotta be tough, you gotta be stronger.